Hey, this is Rance, a reader and author and one half of the Quarantine Book Club podcast. Welcome to QBC Conversations, where I take some deep dives into books and stories by independent authors and maybe help you find a new favorite read. Make sure to check out the Quarantine Book Club wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and consider supporting featured authors by buying their books, writing reviews, and spreading the word. Thanks for listening. Hey guys, this is Rance, one half of the QBC podcast. I am here today with another QBC Conversations with you, with my friend, Jamie Jackson, who I can't wait to get to it. I sort of knew without knowing before we knew each other. And that's the thing we're going to talk about today. Maybe a little bit. But Jamie is the author of two books, well, actually like 1,000 books, but two that are out right now, Fear and Fury and Torment and Tarnished. You can find both of those on Amazon by just searching Fear and Fury, Jamie Jackson, and Torment and Tarnished, Jamie Jackson. So Jamie, how are you this morning?
Doing well, especially for a Monday.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry that I picked today.
No, Monday is fine because I don't have to work today.
That's real adult action right there that you're doing, by the way. You're like, I'm great with Mondays.
I know.
I'm not at all. But I also don't need to work today, which is why it worked fantastically.
Yeah.
So I'm set, even though my eyes look like two piss holes in the snow. I should be sleeping. So you just, December 7th, released book two. I was about to say release number two, and that I just realized
that's a totally different thing.
And so you thanks for laughing with me, by the way. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
it shows me what level we're on. We're in the same place.
Yes, exactly.
So you just released book two in your Adventures of a Villain Leaning Humanoid series. Is that the appropriate title for it?
I think so. Yeah.
It is now.
It's stuck with it. It's up there. It's not going
anywhere. And I think it's a great name for the series. So you just released book two about a little less than a month ago. How are you feeling?
Excited because I still have six more that are, well, we started editing book three just this past Friday, basically. My editor sent me a message that morning. She was like, make sure you've sent me the latest
like iteration of it.
Latest copy of it because I'm starting on it today. And I went, wait, what? I thought we were starting after the holidays. She's like, no, I'm starting now.
So is your editor someone that you like, a personal friend, or is it somebody entirely professional, like an entirely professional relationship?
Okay. So we actually met through a mom's club.
Through a mom's club, yes.
So, and I knew her, I knew like she did editing and stuff like that. And then when I got started on writing my main beta, who has put up with every single first draft and read through everything as it develops. So I guess she's like an alpha, beta, and omega at this point.
She is all the things. She is all the things.
I text her constantly. She puts up with a lot of shit from me. So when I was putting these together and writing the stories, and she was like, if you're going to publish these, you should talk to Mary Beth because she does this for a living. And so I was like, okay, yeah, because, you know, I really do need to get an editor. So I'll just feel her out and see what she wants to do. And she said, yeah, let's do it. And it worked out really, really well because her advice is just on point. Like she's really good at picking out things that need expansion or don't make any sense, need clarity, all of that.
It's really hard as a writer to pull yourself out at a distance enough from your own writing to be like, this is either garbage or this is really good, but still does nothing to help me. So I need to get rid of it, which is such a painful thing to do.
Where I'm over here, like when she's like, this doesn't make sense, you should just either switch this around or cut it. I'm like, give me the knife.
Yeah, that's how I've gotten to. I'm like, you know what? Let me cut it. I have no
let's go.
I have no obsession anymore over words or sometimes
there,
sequences.
There are no more darlings for us.
No, they're all dead. To hell with that phrase too, in its own regard, right? Like
they are all fair game. Yeah,
you have to, in the end, nobody knows what the other than the final product, they know nothing else that leads to that. So it's like anything that you lose is not really lost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you say you have at least 8 books in the series. I have been super excited to ask you about that because I do have some questions about like how you've written them, where this idea came from. But before we do that, I want to ask you to break down for me or summarize what Fear and Fury and Torment and Tarnish are about. Who is it? Megara?
Megara?
Okay.
Megara, I'm not sure what the correct pronunciation
this is
would
from
be.
The so author. This is from the author herself. No this idea how it's pronounced.
No, I don't actually know. This is the real reason why Meg goes by Meg.
Yes, yes.
Because the author doesn't know how to say her own name.
But at least you're honest about it. There's so many things that we have to be like, I don't fucking know how to say it or do it.
I don't know. It was a nice name. I like the name. It has a reason for being, but we're just going to call her Meg because...
So tell me what is Meg's story about? What is Fear and Fury about? What can people expect when they pick up your book?
Okay, so Meg is a person with power, you know, would be a superhero or a villain in that kind of world. And she is just sick of their shit and doesn't want to be involved in any of that. She's had some past experience where she's decided this is just not for me. And I don't want to live that kind of life. And she basically gets forced into it anyway.
Going into it, I did not expect that it was going to be a superhero story, which I absolutely loved. I love superhero lore. I like to think I know more about it than I actually do. And there's a ton of like Easter eggs in your first book in particular. And it reminds some of the things that I really love about your book. This is the part I get to praise you for a minute. You ready? Okay, just absorb it all.
Yeah.
Some of the things that I really love about your book, first and foremost, and I think will give people a good idea as to what they can expect. It is phenomenal first person writing. I don't know what idiot out there decided that there had to somehow be some kind of distinction between good writing is only third person and first person is stupid. Whoever that is, I want to find them and put my elbow in their teeth.
Just smack them like right upside the head. What is wrong with you?
I don't know where it's just some stupid shit that people talk about.
Yeah.
It's a first person voice that is absolutely spectacular. Meg is such a fun character to read alongside and learn about and go on this adventure with. She is a pain in the ass. She's a pain in the ass for people around her. She's not really a pain in the ass for the reader though, which I love. She provides only as much information as we really need. And it is a very conservative book. Now, when I say that, I don't mean like ideas. I mean, it's Meg only tells us what we need to know. There is a conservation of information and we're going to get that clearly later on in the series. It's clear even from the first one that in Fear and Fury, you're only piecemealing and breadcrumbing us what we need. And
I didn't want to info dump on
people. There's none of it. You know, like, there's none of it. And I'm a guy who's, I'm all about a good info dump now and then, but there's none of it. And it's paced so well. I think I tore your book up in 2 sittings. And it is a world inhabited by, it's our world inhabited by superheroes. And these superheroes are sort of like Watchmen-esque, where they're not the best people ever.
No.
But also they're not as morally disingenuous or disenfranchised as like characters in The Boys or even the characters in Alan Moore's Watchmen. They're a little more wholesome. The ways in which they die is not very wholesome, but but yeah, so I loved your book from beginning to end. It was so damn fun. You have a tagline on your book is that Meg's like Deadpool except for funner, and I need to be honest with you, I don't know that reference. Can you please help me out? You told me at one
Legally
point.
Blonde.
I was embarrassed.
Legally Blonde.
Oh, is it Legally? Okay.
Legally Blonde. It'll be just like, I think it's Spring Break, except for funner.
See, I didn't know that. And now I know.
Yeah.
Why Legally Blonde of all things?
Oh my God.
You go from
Deadpool
to Legally Blonde.
I love that movie. Okay, so I would say the Deadpool reference is, you know, in part her snark, her sarcasm, the fourth wall breaking, but also there's an element of the dramatic and the I don't need your help. Yeah. I'm obviously capable that you get from Legally Blonde, because in the movie, Reese Witherspoon's character realizes that she can do this. She doesn't need other people to save her.
Yeah, yeah.
Which Meg states from the beginning. But there's a strength to the character that you wouldn't necessarily expect when the movie starts out.
I think there's sometimes too with Fear and Fury where there's times where I want Meg to just accept help from the world around her. And she's like, no, absolutely not.
No,
fuck off.
Yes.
Which I like that though, because I think one of the most essential parts of having a good first person character is that they don't think the same way that your audience thinks. If your audience is thinking 10 steps ahead of them and they do exactly what the audience expects, sure, they may be a trustworthy character in some capacity, but I don't necessarily think that makes them a character. So I really love Meg's willingness to just not, she definitely does not make the decisions the audience would.
Oh, no.
Which is,
I've had more than one person come to me and be like, what is she doing?
Good.
What is she doing? Why is she making that choice? And I'm like, because that's Meg. What? Like she acts impulsively. She acts in the moment. And she doesn't generally think things through before she does it. She just jumps into what she wants to do.
She's impulse embodied. Even to the fact that when we first meet her, and one of my favorite sequences of the book is the beginning. There's several sequences in the book that I absolutely love. One is the beginning. Two, in Fear and Fury, there's a point at which Meg is sort of hiding out in someone's compound. And there's some phenomenal dialogue between 3/4 characters, one who becomes Liquid. Spoiler alert, I'm just going to say who it is. and
not end well.
When I say becomes Liquid, it's not a superpower. If you consider them becoming Liquid and being dead as a result of them being Liquid. And then the very end, the final confrontation. It's a really like wonderfully classically paced story, an introduction, exposition up to the climax, and then the conclusion / denouement, as they would say. We meet Meg though, working at a big box store.
I know.
And she's like, I don't want to, this is what I want to do. I want to work at this big box store. I want to be
nobody. I want to be nobody.
And we get the idea that Meg has had a history, but we don't get all the details of that. And it's so intentionally breadcrumbed to us. Where did Meg come from, Jamie? Like, where is this character? What is the root of this character that you've written 8 books about now?
Okay, so literally the first 2 lines for the book just popped up in my head one day, and they just kind of sat there for a while. And initially I put down notes for this unnamed character. And originally they were going to be telekinetic. They were going to have that power. And then, you know, of course, one day in the middle of doing what you do with chores and driving and everything, I went, what about fear? Because very few heroes have that power. And what would that be like for somebody to have that kind of power where, you know, if anytime they bring it out, people run from them. They can't get close to people in general because their own power pushes people mm-hmm. away from them.
It reminds me, what are some of your favorite superhero stories?
So I don't read comic books.
That's okay.
Because I'm that kind of fan.
Me too. It's okay to admit
that. The one who gets gatekeeped because I don't know all the backstories and that kind of stuff. And I have, since I was young, Batman has always been my favorite because, you know, my parents would watch the Michael Keaton.
Which
Batman.
Phenomenal movies. Batman, by the way.
He's a really good Batman.
He's just a little bit wild and like unpredictable and a little bit broken up here, the way that no other Batman are.
Yes. And so I would say those movies probably had a big influence on how I viewed superheroes in the first place, because he's a complex character. He is a gray character. Even though he's making choices to do things to make it better for other people.
Yeah.
So
Meg lingers on this. She what I like to call fencing, where it's like she's like trying to dance on this fence between the good side of the lawn and the really crappy side of the lawn. And every time one of the guys from the good side of the lawn comes over, Meg's like, you know what? I don't like you guys. I'm gonna go to the bad side for a bit. But it's funny that you mentioned the idea of a hero having a power of fear, which is what Meg has. And we oftentimes associate the powers that superheroes have in superhero media, like they are just as morally categorized as the superheroes themselves. So we wouldn't imagine that a hero character would have the power to inspire fear in others. Did you intend to have Meg, as you began writing, that her powers were this embodiment of this morally gray side of her?
Yeah. Like it's hard for me to describe verbally because I tend to do obviously better in text. But yeah, like she was morally gray from the beginning. And part of that is because that is her power. Like, you know, fear is not something you want to inspire in people if you're a good person. Generally,
she's a she's the all of the X-Men in one person, and I say that with absolute compliment because I'm not the biggest X-Men fan, and she has all of like the complex thoughts that X-Men have, where it's like, you know, you've got Charles Xavier and Magneto who are like, you could do good things with your powers instead of bad things. And Magneto's like, but I want the freedom to do the bad things. And those are, so they're inside of Meg a little bit. There is Rogue, right? This one of the things I will say, I always thought Rogue was a very well-designed character because Rogue, while being a good person at heart, had the capacity to absolutely destroy anyone around her. And she also had to remain at a physical distance from people. And that was who I thought a lot about when I was reading Meg's story, was Rogue.
Yeah.
You phenomenally describe this power that she has as these like dark tendrils that reach out and they consume someone, crush them, surround them with fear. And even some of her most powerful superhero friends like Greg are terrified of this ability. So I think that Meg is really compelling because not only is she outside of this good and bad superhero balance, but also the people that just like want to bring her into it are also a little terrified of her too.
They are.
Why Greg? Why the name Greg? Can we talk about that? I love it. We're so often surrounded by tales of people with names that are so extravagant. And now we have Greg.
Yeah, then we have Greg. So basically, Greg, the reason I picked his name was I was sitting there and I was writing the coffee shop scene where the two of them are talking. And, you know, Meg mentions that he didn't give her his name. And I reached that point and I went, oh, shit, I didn't give him a name. So I sat there for a good, I don't know, 5-10 minutes going, what's a name for somebody I don't know?
Yeah.
I don't want to pick a name of somebody that I know. And I sat there and I was like literally blank staring. And then I was like, I don't know Greg.
I'm going to use Greg.
So I'm going to use Greg. And then while my editor is working on this book, she's like, I really like the fact that their names rhyme. I think it's really
Meg and
cute.
Greg. Yeah.
Meg and Greg. And I went, that, you know what? Yes. That was intentional.
I picked up on that. But also there was no point at which it felt odd or forced or that even intended. It was just, there's plenty of people in life who just have these rhyming names and they just happen.
It was most definitely not intentional.
I also love that you have this heroic character who is Meg's, and when I'm saying other half, I mean like partner in the sense of they become buds and are forced into a circumstance where they're both going after the same antagonist in Fear and Fury.
Yeah.
And they're of course at each other's throats at times as well.
A little bit.
And there's also some like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. There may be some smoochy smooches that are anticipated, but also just the fact that his name is Greg makes me smile.
I know.
I don't know why.
I think because it feels like a commonplace name. Like you have this hero, he's got these abilities, and you would think he would have some sort of heroic sounding name. And it's Greg.
My name is Greg.
It's Greg.
And my favorite character in the first book, I have two favorite characters.
Okay.
I love them all. And I say that without trying to just like, you know, unnecessarily lift you up because come on, our egos can only deal with so much inflation, right? I love Virgil. However, Virgil is a character in the first book that Greg and Meg seek assistance from. Yep. And he is, tell me if I'm right or wrong, he is a wise man, but he's also a bit of an asshole. And he's also a bit of a prepper and like a survivalist and brings with everything that you would expect from someone who thinks he knows everything, is a kind and gentle soul, but also has a fucking go bag stuffed in his.
I know he does. He does. He's got a go bag. Virgil is certainly, I don't want to say arrogant, but because he is so knowledgeable and tends to have his fingers in a lot of pies in terms of what he knows and what he gets up to, he tends to have that confidence level to him. So he is a little bit asshole-ish in a way. And he's got some flair to him.
And he's also got a great car.
Yes.
Are you a car person?
So I like classic American muscle cars. I have no clue how they work, but I like them. And then I have the advantage that my husband, his brothers have classic American muscle cars that, you know, they've basically rebuilt from the ground up.
That's so cool. I envy that ability.
I have people I can go harass and be like, hey, how does this work if I have questions?
Do you ever just go to them and say, for research purposes, I need you to get in my car and safely drive me very quickly, please. Thank you. And if you haven't, can you please?
Unfortunately, I did not get that option. However, I have driven with one of his brothers before. We were in his truck. Just like right up on people's bump, like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
But like you're also sitting there going, please don't kill us.
I don't want to die. I don't want other people to die.
There was no way he was wrecking us, but at the same time, it was like, is the seatbelt on right? I'm just gonna check that real quick.
I love Virgil because I also think that his car is sort of an extension of his own ego.
Yeah,
we always see cars are weirdly enough attached to ego. It's like dogs where you can look at a dog and be like, I know what kind of owner you have. But the same with cars. You can look at a car and be like, I know what kind of person drives that car. And that's not wrong in Virgil's case.
No, it is not wrong. Virgil's definitely a car guy.
Virgil's a car guy. And then there's my other favorite character who her name is Bolt. And I think the reason I love Bolt so much is that in a world where we have Meg, Greg, and Virgil, and these are people with superpowers, right? Uh-huh. And they have Greg and Virgil have their other names. But Bolt is just Bolt. And Bolt does exactly what you can expect, which is Bolt goes fast. Bolt is the Flash. Yes. And I couldn't help but appreciate your tongue-in-cheek suggestion that the Flash sort of sucks because Bolt sort of sucks. Like you can always feel it's like Bolt is a bit of a takedown on the Flash. It's like the only superpower the Flash has is I go fast.
Oh, I go fast.
The only thing that Bolt has is I go fast. What a shitty superpower.
I know. The only thing it's really good for is running away. Yeah.
Doesn't Bolt say that at one point? I can't remember specifically, but I believe somebody says something like that at one point in the book, right? Like the only thing that it's good for is running away. And Meg, it might be like Meg busting Bolt's ass or something like that. Maybe I created a part of your book that doesn't exist.
I think it's the part where Meg makes a comment to the reader about the reader needing to check their preconceptions about people with speed related powers. That might be what it is, because Bolt herself is, I don't give her a ton of description, but she herself is built like a bodybuilder.
Gotcha.
You know, she's got some muscle to her and she could kick your ass,
of course,
pretty easily, because she has that, you know, that kind of strength to her. So she doesn't look all wispy like you would think somebody who runs quickly
would. Right. Look. Well, yeah, you're her. And the other thing too is that, like, physiologically, I just put that word out there and I'm so afraid I was going to stumble over it. Physiologically, if somebody is going that quickly and moving that fast, their body has to be built to withstand that. Or they would just turn into mist as they ran.
They would goo themselves.
I like Bolt because Bolt holds on to this idea that superheroes, they need their names and their presence, and they're like, I am here to do a very specific thing, and if you're not behind that, then fuck you.
Yeah.
And almost forgets that being a superhero brings with it a certain amount of collateral damage, that like there is the I think a lot I can't help but think about like the Marvel Cinematic Universe when I think about your books, because you've got the superhero level things that are happening at the in the superhero world, and then there's the surface level underneath it, which is where you still have people with superpowers, but they're dealing with more everyday problems. And that to me is Meg. And I've really loved those kind of stories where if we look at like Daredevil on Netflix, or I just really want them to say that that's actually a part of the MCU again, where, you know, you have your big heroes who are clashing in the air and all of the other people on the ground are dealing with the fallen debris. And that's who Meg is. Yeah. She's one of the people on the ground who doesn't want to deal with the superhero shit. Do you have a certain kind of resentment towards the usual superhero narrative?
The usual superhero narrative tends to focus a lot on the big stuff, the world saving stuff. And what I wanted to do was tell a smaller story. This, you know, this is what it's like in the everyday life of the hero. This is, you know, it's not always about saving the world. It's not always this villain who's planning on taking things over. Sometimes it's just this villain is here to kill you and only you. You know, it's the smaller stuff, the smaller stories that I wanted to tell with Meg.
Do the other books in the series stay on that level, or do they get larger in scope as they go on?
I would say they probably get a little bit larger in scope as they go on, simply because Meg enters into this world. And so it's going to require that she ends up being exposed to more of what goes on. But overall, I would say the story itself stays focused on Meg and what's going on with her, because even though I bring in more villains, and some of them are sympathetic villains, some of them are the villains you love to hate, and when they go down, you're going to cheer that they went down the way they did.
Thank God for that. God, there's enough people to, there's two sides of the coin. You've got people who never kill their bad guys, and then people who kill them constantly.
Yeah.
And it seems like you're somewhere in the middle of that.
Oh, yeah, I would say somewhere in the middle, because throughout the story, there are, I would say Virgil kind of forcibly adopts people into his team. So, and you know, some of them are not necessarily good people. Right. They, but they have a chance to become better people than they were. So
that's where Meg is at as well. She's not a good person. And I don't say that to insult her. I know that sometimes as writers, we have a certain love for characters because we're in their head all the time. And we're like, but I want people to like this character. I love Meg. I think she's great. But she's also not the best person in the world, which thank God she's not.
She's not the best person in the world. I wanted her to stay flawed. Mm-hmm. You know, she can't be perfect. There are times where you'll agree with her. She has good viewpoints. And then there are other times where you're going to be like, why are you being such a hypocrite right now? Why? Because sometimes she is. She can be hypocritical and she is impulsive. But there are other times where the choices that she makes are good choices. Yes. With regard to protecting other people.
Meg comes across as someone to me who is dealing with, but never speaks about a lot of the traumas in her own life, whether it is people she lost or relationships that she has either seen destroyed or has destroyed herself, because we've all been there. We've all done that.
Yeah.
And so I think Meg is, to use a term that a lot of people despise, but I'm going to use it anyway, because fuck people. Meg is really relatable to me. For one, she's that first person narrator that I love so much. But two, I feel myself reflected oftentimes in how she looks at the world, where she is sometimes afraid to get close to people because she might damage them in some capacity, whether with her presence or her powers that she can't really control yet. Or she's also afraid of people damaging her. Like, she's an immensely fragile character, but I never feel like it is mailed in or used as a, it is a flaw, but not exploited as a weakness.
Yeah.
And finding that gentle place to balance is something that I think you're pretty expert at when it comes to this. Is Meg speaking to anybody? Is Meg speaking to anyone as a narrator? I've always wondered, as I was reading the first book, there's so many fantastic times where she breaks the fourth wall and she speaks directly to the audience. And whenever an author does that, I can't help but wonder, is she speaking to me or is she speaking to someone else and I'm just in their place?
I wanted it to come across as she is speaking to the reader directly. So she's talking to the reader as if they are there listening to her tell this story. So I didn't have anyone specific in mind that she was addressing at the time. So I like that.
I like it when an author drags us into a story like that, because I feel like I get to hang out with these superheroes.
Yeah. Superheroes just dragging you around, dealing with all these villains and monsters and things.
The first time that you mentioned this, I saw this book floating around Twitter before I'd really gotten a chance to meet you. And I was like, oh my gosh. This looks really cool. I love the cover of it. And then I found out that you have 8 books in this series, 2 of which are released. The others are coming.
Uh-huh. Yep.
What is the span of time we're looking at with this, Jamie? Like, how long have you been working on these?
Okay. So basically what happened was, I guess you would basically call this a pandemic baby.
The whole thing?
The whole thing. Okay. So what happened was,
holy shit, I'm over here like sweating just thinking about it.
Hold up. So everything had shut down, right? And then they told us we were virtually schooling. And I'm not meant to be a teacher. There's a reason I'm not a teacher. Everybody is always like, oh, you're so patient. How are you so patient? I'm like,
alcohol.
Because I'm not listening.
Oh, yeah.
It slides right past me.
Right.
So the reason I'm not a teacher is I don't have the organizational skills for that. I don't actually have the patience to do that. And I can't focus the way you would need to, especially if it's like small kids. And so here I am, all of a sudden I'm having to help my second grader and kindergartner.
You just manage.
manage to get them to sit still in front of a screen for their teacher in the first place. So they aren't getting the interactivity that they're used to because they're staring at a screen.
Yeah.
Which, for my oldest is not, he can't learn that way. He can't.
I think so few people can. I really do. I think it's a lot more difficult. It was a thing we needed to do. Like, and I say this from a, you know, from a teacher standpoint, which I love that you're like, I'm not organized enough to that. Jamie, do you think I'm an organized person? Not at all. My brain is a mess and I can barely exist.
I honestly have no idea how teachers do it because, like, oh my gosh, bless them. Because just some students, some parents are just crazy.
Great. Oh, 100%. But you also have to be a little bit too to teach, I think.
Yeah. Like it's
totally.
It's often like a thankless kind of job. Basically,
you know what? I'm at that point now where I'm like, thank God, please don't thank me. I don't need to be thanked. I just want to not read emails past 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's my thanks.
just don't talk to me. Don't talk to me. We're done.
You wrote 8 books when you were like, okay, I am.
I'm not even done here.
Jesus, so, I am nervous hearing this.
September through December, right? And I'm like losing my mind. And so I decided, you know what, this is my New Year's resolution. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write and I'm going to actually finish a story because I need something that's for me, especially right now when there's nothing for me. So I sat down after New Year's and I wrote a story and it was Mandalorian fan fiction. It was bad.
I like how you hesitated for a moment and you were like, it's Mandalorian. For one, fan fiction kicks ass. Two, the Mandalorian
kicks ass. My best work. It's not my best work. We'll put it that way. But I sent the first draft to my main beta, the person who became my main beta, who was fucking awesome. Thank you. I love her. So I sent it to her and she was like, this is good. So I did a second draft and I changed the viewpoint. She was like, this is better. I was like, thanks. I would hope so at that point. And she's like, you know, maybe you should actually write a story. And so I'd had those two lines just kind of sitting around in my head for over the past year. And so at this point, we're like midway through February. So I sat down and I wrote the first draft of the first book and was sending it to her throughout and then got started on the second book. And so by the time May rolled around and the first book was published, I was already writing book 4 and I think it gotten started on 5
Good
at that
God.
Point.
What are you're a fucking machine.
Part of the issue was I basically went like 10 or so years without writing anything. And it was like lancing a wound. It just all poured out. That's what happened. And so I ended up with like 8 books by the time the end of July rolled around, I think, at that point.
Wait, is this February to July?
Yeah.
I am fucking speechless over here. 8 books?
I kind of always dismiss it because I'm like, well, they're all only around like 65,000 words. And people are like,
that's like,
yeah, but it's 8 books.
Yeah, seriously. And for one, like a book is a book is a book, right? Like whether it's 50,000, 60,000, or whether it is 400,000, a book is a book is a book. And it's still an emotional, productive process where you're constantly ripping out your own thoughts and you're like, oh, is this good? Is this bad? Do I like it? So you smashed out. Did you, I'm going to ask the forbidden question, but I have to know. Did you deeply plan these or are you like, I'm going to shoot from the hip?
Okay. So initially when I wrote the first book, I was planning on it being a standalone. And so I wrote that and then was like, well, I kind of want to keep going. So, you know, then the second book happened and with the way it was going and to like, you know, get the first draft done and then I'm starting on the third and I'm like, you know what? They kind of need a plot. Like a story to connect all 3 books. Cause I didn't want it to just be single bad guy things. And, you know, you have single bad guys coming into the books, but there's an overarching plot throughout the whole thing. When you get to find out in the 8th book, what exactly was going on. And it does connect back to the first book. So I did end up plotting, which I didn't do purposely. It sort of happened.
When you write good material, I think that good material feeds on itself. And that like in your brain and on the page, you'll write something good early And when I mean good, I don't even mean by it has to be the best words ever. It's just a good anchor of thought that you'll find you'll come back to later and be like, oh my God, I feel so brilliant. But it's because it's just such a fundamentally functional piece of the DNA of a story that you're like, oh my gosh, these callbacks are just so natural because I was working with good material and great thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. So
eight books. My ass is still kicked.
The ninth is almost finished. Technically I have the end written. I'm just trying to finish up this final fight scene going on. And then I have to type up, because I have it saved in my phone, but type up the ending of that one into the main document.
Saved in my phone. Are you a phone writer? I'm going to throw you out the window.
I mostly write at the computer.
Okay.
But I am the kind of writer where wherever I am,
you'll write.
I will write.
Good on you.
I have written on scraps of paper. I take notes in my phone. I have gone in and done talk to text and just dictated at it before.
I'm fast.
Those are fun when you go back through and you're like, what did I say? What word was this supposed to
be?
I'm
really fascinated by that, though, because I think so often we tell ourselves, we have narratives in our head about like, I can't write. This is me. I am a get it all out on the page and then stop writing for months. Get it on the page, stop writing for months kind of person. And I don't know where that habit came from. I know when I first started writing seriously, we all have desk books, right? I have these two absolutely massive fantasy tomes that I wrote in 2004. And it was just like me sucking down cigarettes, because yes, I was a smoker. Me sucking down cigarettes and drinking coffee and staying up to like 4 a.m, just writing this magnum opus that came out to like 900,000 words between two books.
Holy shit.
And then happened over the course of a year. After that, I realized that wasn't a healthy approach for me to take as a writer. This, however, seems like it works really well for you. Like, is there any part of your process where you feel like you really hit that flow and you just go, or are you just a constantly productive person?
I would say that I basically write in sprints throughout the day. It'll hit me in the middle of chores if I'm out running errands. And you know, you just try to get notes down about the scene at the very least, so you can go back and fill in all the details later when you physically type it up on the computer. And so, you know, with the first eight books, I was doing it constantly. Like, I'd be in the middle of like bedtime routines and stuff like that, and I'd be
tapping on your phone. That's so cool.
Yeah, tapping on the phone while the kids are brushing their teeth and stuff. So you know, just getting it down when it would come to me. And I do try to have like a set time where in the morning where I sit down at the computer to sit and write. Yeah. And generally it takes a couple minutes for my brain to kind of engage. I'll have music going because that generally helps me focus on what I'm doing. Cause if it's quiet, I cannot.
Me neither.
I can't. It ends up being too quiet, which in a house full of people, you would think I'd be like, yay, no noise. No, I have a very fine line between just enough noise and too much noise. And then
what's your time frame, if I may ask, for having the first eight? I know you mentioned the nine, and I keep attaching myself to this eight. I don't know why.
I only just started writing the ninth because like there was like a good 6 month period where I wasn't doing anything other than like, you know, editing on the first eight instead of continuing
on the writing.
So
what's your time frame for getting these released? If it's like, I'm gonna say now, if you release them all soon, people won't be sad. But also I feel like if you release them all soon, you're going to be like, well, fuck it. I guess I got to go on to the next thing that's 10 books long. So like, what's your plan for getting them out there?
So basically the plan is every 6 months to release the next one, because that gives my editor time to sit down and for us to go through the edits together, as well as give my cover artist, you know, some time to get me scheduled in. So that way we can get the covers and stuff done. And so hopefully that's the plan. And we'll see how that works out.
I really can't wait to jump into the second book. Your cover was far different for Torment and Tarnish than I expected. But it's beautiful. It is this gorgeous simplicity. Both of your covers are like this, where I am not at all. I firmly believe in, I know that there are publishing trends and people look at covers and they expect things, but that's not how my brain works. And so I love seeing that people sort of break out of that. The first cover is this really classically painted picture of Meg. And the second cover are these two vicious looking claw-like hands that are also, they also have these shadow people inside of them. What was it like working with your cover artist? Did you give them ideas or were you just like, fuck it, go with it?
Okay. So basically here's what happened. I sent him, I was still in the middle of drafts with the first one. And I was like, hey, Tyler, would you, if I go with self-publishing, would you be willing to do the cover art for me? And he was like, yeah, I got it. Just send me what you need. So I sent him the book in one of the drafts and he sat down and he read it and he came back and he was like, I was like, okay, so what did you think? And he was like, it's good. There's a lot of swearing.
Yeah, I'm cool with that.
I was like, yeah, that's we're going to go through and cut some of that. Cause there was, probably double.
Really?
What ended up in the library. I know. Yeah.
And there, I mean, like, there's a lot.
It's like flow of consciousness as I write it. So I don't necessarily pay attention to
numbers of cuss words.
Like I don't pay attention to, is this a good time to swear or not? I don't pay attention to that. I just write it as it comes through. So, you know, it ended up that way. And yeah, a lot of it got cut. So he asked me, well, what are you thinking for the cover? And I was like, I have no idea. I don't know. You're the artist. Like you tell me what we're doing. And so I had sent him a photo of, what is the actress's name? I can never remember her name. She plays Stella Bonaparte in CSI New York. And her character is Greek and she's got, you know, the curls. Like, so I had sent him a photo of her and I was like, this is basically the inspiration for Meg's hair. And that's about all I could tell you. And that's what he came up with.
You mentioned the Greek thing. So I have to ask now, and I'm staring right at the camera as I say this. I don't think this name just popped out of nowhere. Are we going to see a mixture in the future as the books go on? Like, as I was reading the first book, I couldn't help but think about her name. I think a lot of the time Greco-Roman, classicism is back in our collective conscience because of things like video games. I think about stuff like, you know, Hades that came out a year and a half ago, beautiful video game. And, you know, you're fighting the Furies at one point. I think back also to like God of War. So I think that our brains are back in this place where like, oh yeah, I'm all about like Greek gods and Roman gods. Mashing that together with a superhero thing. Is there a mashup intended there? Can we anticipate the possibility that there might be some like mythology in this or?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not to be like totally spoiler, but like when you hit the third book, it really starts to come in more strongly with Greek mythology telling. So
do you like the capital C classics in that regard?
I definitely grew up reading the classics, the stories of the gods and the heroes and all that kind of stuff. And granted, the stories that I read were cleaned up a little.
Yeah, of course.
You know, since I was a kid, so they were a little more family friendly.
Yeah, you can't toss about people like slinging. What is slinging seed over their shoulder into the water and like,
they included stuff like that. The throwing of dragon's teeth and stuff like they included the violence. It was the, the parts with like Zeus and the other male gods
their dalliances
activities.
My father gave me at one point. He was like, I know you really like mythology. So I got you this. it was a statue of Hercules throwing, mm-hmm. I wish I could remember who it was, and I can't remember, throwing his opponent into a pit of man-eating horses, and I can't remember who it was. Do you remember?
No. Oh, man.
I'm going to look it up as we're here, but
I think it was like the same guy who basically made him come clean up the stables of those said man-eating horses. So I think it was like some king or something.
Hercules and the man-eating mares, Diomedes. He's throwing, I guess it's Diomedes. Jesus. Yeah. He's throwing Diomedes into this pit of man-eating horses. And Diomedes has his hand just right on his penis. Like, it's grabbing Hercules' wiener. Like, this thing is so tough. It's going to save me. And I just had this statue. I was like, Dad, why don't you give this to me? This is great. But like, I'm really happy to hear that, though. There is a sense of that in the first book, right? There's so much about Meg that we don't know, and there's a lot that she willingly doesn't tell us, and there are suggestions that she's a part of a larger narrative. So, thankfully enough, when you say no spoilers, I don't think even being like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you can expect more of that as a spoiler, because it's there, and it clearly feels intended that we should take that away without revealing too much to us. Done phenomenally. What are some of your expectations when it comes to like what are some of the rules that you follow as a writer? Things that you absolutely always want to see in a book that you write, things that you don't want in there that you'll never do?
Okay. Well, trigger warning, there would never actually be any sort of rape shown on the page, or probably like it might get mentioned as a possibility. It's never going to actually happen. While there might be sexual assault to a degree, there's no actual rape going on. And the good thing about Meg is she can obviously defend herself at least from most of that. While it certainly, I would say it certainly ends up in there. My readers are never going to have to worry that they're going to read a rape scene. That's a no. That's a hard no.
I love hearing somebody else say that. That also is a standard that I hold, because I think that our world is an ugly place. And there are threats to people that on the page, we don't need to make use of dangers like that to establish tension. It's one of the problems that I personally had with something like Game of Thrones, where that was like this extreme sexual violence was like a threat at all times. And it just was such an ugly world that it couldn't even match into that idea of what fantasy should be to me. So I'm really happy to hear that from you, because I think it's a great trust. It's great to be able to trust your writer as you're reading something, to know this is a place they'll never go. And I really like that. Thank you.
And while, you know, because there is Greek mythology retelling, there is some relation to sexual assault. There's certainly a, you know, it's touched upon and it's viewed through the lens of, this is a horrible thing. We don't do this. It's not okay to do this. And we're not letting villains do this to other people. I think in book 9, there is a villain who comes in and they're discussing a previous villain, and Meg makes the offhand comment, what do you care? You're a villain. He's like, I have standards. I have standards. I don't do that.
All of a sudden though, what a phenomenal way to also establish like likeness in that villain too. Right. That like the idea that like, hey, I have fucking rules, man.
Like there's still some sort of honor code. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I would say that the one thing that readers can be assured of is any of my villains who do sexually assault anybody in any of these books is going to die, and they're going to die horribly.
They're going to go down.
They're going to go down. I can guarantee you that, because that's what they deserve.
Good.
Yeah. So, but yeah. And in terms of stuff that is included, I think I like to lean into tropes and cliches. Like, if you're going to include them, have fun with them, you know, kind of joke around about the fact that this cliche is in there and I don't care. Yeah. Like, you know, like, I think, you know, even Meg herself will point it out every so often, like the comments about horror movie cliches and things like that. She'll point it out and kind of invite the reader into mocking the moment with her.
I think we're so often driven as writers to like want, you know, people, it, like there's this pressure to like break the mold. I'm like, I should write a fucking fun story.
Yes.
Like I can write.
Some cliches exist for a reason. People like absolutely. Them. Have fun with them.
And they work. They work in their own place. Like I'm a huge fan of the MacGuffin, right? Like objects of power. I always joke with people like, when you see an object of power in my book, it's going to be important in the plot. Like it's going to happen all the time. And I think though those things are, they establish a reality to a world at the same time though. Mm-hmm. Meg does something that I love. She gets her ass kicked.
I know. she is not, she's not all powerful. She definitely has weaknesses where she's not going to win the fight.
Which I love. I need my protagonists to be in that kind of danger. Even when they have these awesome powers that could shred people apart and do shred people apart. Liquid. I just can't help it. There is literally, you've written a sequence in your first book that I think about on a daily basis. And that's not an exaggeration. What is your favorite part of Fear and Fury? Like what was your favorite sequence to write? I love knowing like those parts that even if they're not your reader's favorites, what are those things that stand out to you? Like, I fucking love this scene.
Oh man. That's a hard one. Just cause like, I honestly love the parts where Meg is ripping people apart. But I would say some of my favorite moments are the moments between her and Greg, especially the moment in Virgil's kitchen.
Is this before the ruined rug or after?
I think that one's after.
I couldn't help it. There's this moment where Meg,
I'm not paying for that.
Where Meg throws up on somebody's rug, and like then the next, like a few hours later, she's just like drinking a Coke in the kitchen. She's like, I guess I gotta clean that up at some point.
I know.
Which I loved because it's like it's God. She couldn't be the worst roommate.
No, I know.
Like are there any parts that you like that you remember, like you loved how it felt when you wrote it, or you like have a good memory of writing a specific sequence?
I guess it would be like a spoiler, so you know, cover your ears if you don't want to know.
If you haven't read Fear and Fury by Jamie Jackson, I want you to go ahead and stop this podcast right now. You can pick it up on Amazon. Read it. It will literally take you 6 hours to read, so fucking do it. And then continue from here.
Yes. So their first kiss.
Okay.
I honestly love that part. That wasn't in the first draft where it is. Where it ended up. So it's one of my favorites. I like that scene a lot.
Your story.
And then I
go for it. No, I'm sorry. I stepped on you. I stepped on your.
I realized the other day. So I have someone who does who I've commissioned for character art, and at some point I want to have them do like a cute couple scene. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, what if I have them draw the first kiss scene between Meg and Greg? And then I went, oh wait. That moment's actually kind of scandalous because here's Greg. He's not wearing a shirt. Meg's in her pajamas.
They better be frumpy pajamas though, right?
No.
Oh, they're not frumpy pajamas?
I'm assuming she's the kind of person who like sleeps in a t-shirt and like shorts.
Yeah, well, that's sort of like, frumpy, right? Like not what we expect. It's not that movie, like that movie beauty of the first kiss where it's like, I'm in the perfectly matched lingerie and he's... super cut in a pair of tight jockey shorts, like that. She's just like wearing a t-shirt and it's like a Led Zeppelin t-shirt with a pair of somebody else's shorts.
She would have a Led Zeppelin t-shirt.
She say she wouldn't.
She would. She would.
Yeah.
She would.
Yeah. But it's kind of.
And she probably acquired it from somebody else and didn't tell them that she took it.
I'm taking this guy's fucking Led Zeppelin t-shirt, and that's the price he pays.
Sneaking out for the walk of shame. She's like, you know what? I'm just going to take this.
The walk of shame. Well, yeah, but I also think that she'd probably just look better in that damn shirt anyway than whoever she took it from. So
honestly, yeah,
or but she's also not the kind of person who's going to buy it from the big box store pre-weathered.
Yeah, no. She's going to get one that somebody got at a concert somewhere and has worn it to perfection. And then they go to check their drawer the next morning.
Like, where is this at? Sure. So what is the proper balance for you as a writer? Like Fear and Fury is really, I think, well-paced. There is a ton of action in it. I think back to the action sequence in the apartment. I think to the very end with the drive-in, which, by the way, the setting for your final confrontation is so nostalgic to me, because we're in an era now where like stuff like drive-ins, they're not really around anymore. But here in Maryland, we have one that is immensely famous, and I could like walk to it, which is amazing. But that's not something that a lot of people really know about nowadays. Is like, the, you know, drive-in movies. I love the setting for the final confrontation of the first book. How do you hit that nice pace between like a little bit of romance, a little bit of action, a little bit of violence? Like what's your formula for making that work?
I have no formula. I literally just pants the shit out of where I'm going with this, because generally, I knew how I wanted it to start. I knew how I wanted it to end. And it was just, well, we'll see where we end up from there. Like, we're just going to try and get from point A to point B, and whatever squiggly lines show up in the middle, that's the way it goes. I think I luck out with a lot of things. It just kind of worked out well. And hopefully I've kept that with the, you know, the other books, with the pacing with them. And generally, I think my aim is just, I think I aim for a lower word count, like 65,000 words is basically where I aim to go, because that helps me keep it tighter and shorter, because I don't feel like I have to fill in all of this stuff.
Can I have that ability, please? Can you cut a part of that off and give it to me? Because I am a wordsy words McWordserson, and I need that ability. Be like, 65 is perfect.
65 is perfect. Like, it works for me, because honestly, I don't know that I could reach something higher than that. Like, once I get, I'll start writing, I hit like the 10,000 word count, and then it's kind of like an uphill struggle to get to 30, and then 30 onwards, it slowly gets easier until I hit about 50. And then it's kind of like a nice downhill slide at that point. If I were to aim for something larger, I don't think I could finish the story if I were to try and write 100,000 words in a novel.
In the first book, who is your, if like your favorite character? We all have people that we attach ourselves to and that we want the world to love. So outside of Meg, who is your favorite character in the first book?
Virgil. Yeah. Virgil. Yeah. He's got my favorite superpower. And I love the fact that he personally is so comfortable with what he is, who he is, and what he can do. So he's both very logical in that fashion, but also has that flair for the dramatic at the same time.
What were some of your influences for these books? I think we're a product of those things that we consume and that we love. Mm-hmm. Are there any influences that you can pinpoint, or even things that are really subtle influences that you embraced when you were writing them?
Okay. So obviously, maybe not. Obviously, other superhero stories, The Boys, X-Men, Batman, Superman, just like all of that. Star Wars.
Really?
Love Star Wars. The original three, The Mandalorian.
Says the person who literally just wrote Mandalorian fan fiction, right?
I know. The Mandalorian, it's such a great show, because they really went back to their roots with the Westerns and the Samurai movie. And I would say Westerns surprisingly have something of an influence on me. Just like, I've seen the classic Westerns with Clint Eastwood and those kind of things. let's see, what else? Obviously horror movies and, you know, some horror related stories like, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Near Street. R.L. Stein.
R.L. Stein was a badass, by the way.
He was. I think he still is. Yeah. Like,
he's the most unassuming looking dude, too. He's just like, yeah, just a normal looking guy who clearly just likes to have fun.
Yeah. So like Fear Street, I read so many of those books, and just the way he describes things, there's this one that stands out in particular because there's this evil person who ends up in a car, kind of like Christine, right? She ends up being in a car. She is the car. And he's describing one scene where there's this teenager, he's in the car, she's driving herself, and she goes through a field with people who are playing football. And I specifically remember the scene where he describes the guy looks out the window and somebody's hand is stuck to the side mirror because she hit him on the way through the field. And that has stuck with me in terms of like describing what happens with Meg and her powers. Yeah.
It's funny that you have this memory of distinct like body damage to people. I always think about in Pet Sematary, Stephen King's Pet Sematary, the image that sticks with me, and it will stick with me to the day that I die, was when, Gage, the main character's son, is hit by a truck. And he mentions the Star Wars sneakers still on the road. And I don't know why, but it is this image that I can see in my head. The same way that you see that the hand on the rear view mirror.
Because it's such this little detail, such a little thing to notice in that moment when something horrific has happened. And you just kind of focus in on this one tiny thing. And that one tiny thing tells you everything you need to know about the scene and the emotions in it in that moment.
As someone who is an avowed Western fan, I appreciate, and I did see the Western influence in your first book, especially the sense of lawlessness. Meg exists in this social place where she's done some bad shit and will do some bad shit. None of it is ever to a point where I'm like, I can't trust Meg anymore as a person. But I also accept that this is a world in which people die, and Meg has brought an end to some fucking terrible people, but also there is this lawlessness associated with it that I love, because there is similarly a lawlessness to superhero movies. Very few times, with the exception of something like, if we looking at comic books or even looking at the MCU where they do the Sokovia Accords, very few times are superpowered individuals held to a standard of law. They explore that a little more in The Boys. And this book feels Midwestern to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you kind of get a sense of the lawlessness when Meg herself specifically states, are you going to be the one to tell the guy with the laser eyes that according to his contract, he can't do that? Right. I didn't think so. Yeah.
Thematically speaking too, there's a lot of really cool themes in the first book. I love this continued theme of the lack of control, that fear is a thing that cannot be controlled. Meg desperately tries to do so, but also just as many times as she can control its use, she can't. And that in a way she's also a little afraid of what this ability over fear can do. Red Eye, your antagonist, is this awesome mystery that I can't help. This is where my brain goes. I can't help but think of Cillian Murphy when I think of Red Eye.
Okay.
Because he was in a movie called Red Eye. And so in my head, it was Cillian. Am I even saying that right? Killian? I don't know. Cillian Murphy was the antagonist. But also the fact that Red Eye is a character who we know so little about. And I loved that mystery. I also loved your confidence as a storyteller, because I don't need to know much more about him. And I feel like so often we're expected to be fed knowledge about people's pasts. And sometimes we don't actually, all the people we meet in our life, if they do bad shit to us, we don't always know why. And so I actually like the fact that your antagonist is a tool to learn more about your protagonist, but that we don't have to get the whole backstory behind Red Eye. Was it part of your plan to keep Red Eye a little in the dark and thus make us a little more afraid of him because we don't really know about him?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I intentionally didn't want to just info dump about him, about his motives. There needed to be that mystery to him to make him threatening, because when you know all the information about something, it's not scary anymore.
And that's where your horror influences seem to really feed into this.
Yeah. Yeah. The not knowing is part of the scariest part. Like, you know, they don't know exactly what he's capable of. And they don't know why he's choosing to do what he does.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I loved that, because that to me is super villainy. I don't need to know what these guys are up to. I might not even ever know, because it's beyond my capacity, whether through Meg or as myself, to actually know what they're planning. Yeah. Meg is, she's fenced between the good side, the bad side of that lawn, and people want her because she's got some awesome fucking powers.
Yeah.
It felt very cosmic horror-y, some of her powers over fear. Was that an influence on anything that you had written?
Oh man, I don't know. Cause like, I don't know how much cosmic horror itself that I've read.
It's better to read less.
Like, I think any cosmic horror that I've encountered has probably been through video games.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that BioShock isn't really so much cosmic horror. What's the other one with the dude in space and he's like trying to figure out what happened on that space station?
Like Prey.
Yeah, something like it's like Prey, and then space. There's
Dead
Space. So like that one.
Yeah,
you know, because you don't know what happened here.
Right.
I would say Alien.
Yes.
Like Alien and Aliens have probably had a lot of influence that way. Because throughout those movies, you don't know why the alien is here. You don't know where it came from initially. And they don't ever really explain that. And I think that's part of why this animal is so scary.
Meg seems to me like she would definitely run left if a big wheel a la Prometheus was crashing over the earth towards her. So thank God for that. Because I didn't need, if there's anything I didn't need for the Alien series, it was a prequel that sucked. I think cosmic horror is a really interesting genre, because I don't really know if it knows what it is. We associate so often with H.P. Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft is an asshole and I don't like him.
I haven't read any of the stuff. He can stay right there.
You can keep him over there. It's actually really great. Some really great newer cosmic horror stuff out there. But it's all about that idea of like terror is the thing of which we are afraid, and not knowing is even more terrifying. At least that's how I see it. I can't even begin to conceive what I'm afraid of. I just know that it is a presence. It is frightening, and I am lesser than. And in a way, Meg is lesser than her own power over fear as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that puts Meg in such a cool position as a protagonist, because she's trying to figure out her way to control this power, but she also wants to use it to defend herself.
Yeah.
By choice and not. Even Greg is like, bro, you do some fucking terrible shit. And I am invulnerable to a lot, not to you.
Yeah. And you know, while she can't cause any sort of physical harm to him because of his own powers, she could certainly fuck him up if she wanted to.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Jamie, you my brain shut down for a second. Let me reboot it. Okay, I'm back.
That's okay.
You and I have a really weird connection that I would like to talk more about. Can we do that?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So we knew each other sort of before we knew each other.
Yeah.
you were roommates with somebody I went to high school with.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I know.
Like, that's so, yeah, that's so, yeah, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like one of those weird connections that you're just like, how is the world this small? But it is. Yeah. Is so,
I mean, literally, yeah, we're like what, five states away,
something like
and
that.
And we met, yeah, each other on Twitter first, and it wasn't until we were, yeah, like, oh my god, we have a mutual friend. You went to high school with the person I was a roommate with, which is so, it's, yeah, just so cool.
College. Yeah.
I love that, and I think that's one of the reasons that, like, I've been super excited to talk to you, other than the fact that your book kicks ass. But also because it's like, oh, my friend of my friend is my friend.
Yes.
what can we expect if people out there are listening to this now and they've maybe got Fear and Fury, but they're like me and they haven't had the opportunity to read Torment and Tarnish yet. What are some of the things that you would like to say that they can expect from that second book?
There's definitely a lot of gore. That tradition continues. We've introduced a new character. So by the end of this book, y'all are going to have to pick a team. You're going to have to pick a team because my baiters are telling me that I have ended up with a love triangle. And I was like, no, I didn't. No, I did not. So the second book, basically I had introduced this character with the intention of putting one in. And Meg said, yeah, no, not interested in doing that whole trope here. I was like, okay, fine. We'll scratch that. That's not going to happen. Cause Meg's own personality, it was just like, yeah, no, she is just not into this whole can't pick a thing. So, I have betas who had read up through book four and they're like, you have a love triangle and I'm on this team.
Can't we be team what? All?
Yeah, I would right?
Team, like, all of them. Team Bad Decisions is my favorite team.
Team Bad Decisions. Team Bad Decisions. We are Team Bad Decisions.
Yes, always. Oh God, yeah. I want my protagonists or anybody else. I want them to make bad decisions. I want to go, why the fuck would you do that? Because the truth is, I make bad decisions all the time. Anybody out there who is like, I didn't like that main character because they made bad decisions. I'm like, fucker, you. You literally chose to not pay your bills this week and also decided to take a chance on that, like, 4-day-old chicken that was in your fridge. Like, y'all make bad decisions all the fucking time.
Everybody makes bad decisions all the time.
They're just not on a world-ending level the way it is for some. So,
yeah, the way it is for some. But yeah, no, my main beta is on the wrong damn team. I'm going to tell you that much. She's on the wrong damn team.
Have you told her that?
Yes, multiple times, and I like to point that out every time.
Well, every time she knows you're on the wrong team. No. It clearly sounds like she's not on Team Bad Decisions.
No, she is not on Team Bad. Well, not in a way she's on Team Bad Decisions, but also, you know, not on Team Bad Decisions.
Do you want to really quick for anybody who happened to who's curious and they damn well better be. Do you have anything you want to read really quick from book two or book one?
Oh shit.
I know. I didn't prepare you for this. I didn't.
No, you didn't prepare me for this.
Let me tell you how I organize a conversation, which I go, hey, we're going to do this thing this day. Okay, cool.
We're going to do this thing this day. Hold on.
It's okay. You got it. We're gonna vamp. We're gonna vamp in the meantime. I mean, you could also say, Rance, I don't want to fucking read anything. But I mean, I would love to hear it. Also, because I love hearing a first person narrator from the reader. Uh-huh. Or from the writer. I'm sorry, because it's so often there are things that you're hearing as you create this that we don't. And I always like to know what these words sound like from the writer's voice.
Okay. Let's see. I guess, book one.
Okay, cool.
I'm going to pull out the copy that I use for this.
Do you have like your own personal copy of book one?
Yeah. Okay. So I have this copy here that I use for like the actual reading. So the spine's all broken. And I'll be using that when I actually finally get around to recording the audiobook.
Are you recording the audiobook?
Yes, that is the plan.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. So my husband went to the effort of researching microphones and everything to get me a really good one for doing the actual recording. And his plan is to like build me a little sound booth to cut down on any reverb.
Yeah.
I think is what he said. So the plan is for me to record the audiobook once he gets that
done. And I put this out there, I put this out there because I would love to bounce ideas. I am actually deeply interested in not for my own reading, but to potentially read other people's. So I'm always happy to like share ideas. Like if you get to the point you start like thinking like, okay, here's what I did to make my sound better. Let me know. Let's talk, because I am also in the process of, I would like to record some stories.
Yeah. So we'll see. Cause I have to, I think it was JB has like the thing about recording with ACX.
Yes.
So I need to like sit down and watch that and, you know, figure out what I'm doing. Cause I don't.
Good luck. You got, you can do it. You can do this. So what are you going to read?
The part where, Greg tells Meg that he can hear her heartbeat. So I'm just gonna, okay. He came around to throw his trash away and finally actually looked at me. I can hear your heart beating. What are you planning, Meg? I choked on my coffee and sputtered while I coughed it up. He was next to me with a towel, one warm hand on my back, and for a moment I felt bad about what I had planned. Well, more about the not pointing out the prison he was living in and recommending he get away while he could. Less about the fact that once I had a chance, I was getting out while the getting was good. Nothing, I wheezed out. Jesus. Are you all right? Fine. I coughed a bit more. Don't do that. Do what? His hand was still on my back and his touch was disconcerting. I shifted away from him because I didn't know what answer I wanted to give him. He pulled his hand away. Sorry, he said. You really shouldn't tell a girl you can hear her heartbeat from across the counter, Greg. It doesn't have the effect you think it does.
I like that he says sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, he didn't mean to scare her that way. Like,
I also like that he's so he's confident enough in who he is that he can apologize. We need more male characters who are ready to just apologize, even when they unintentionally do something that's sort of shifty. Right? Like, fucking apologize. I mean, the dynamic between Meg and Greg is spectacular.
They have some good banter moments, and I love it. And that was definitely one of the things I wanted to do with my male characters. I wanted them to have the opportunity to be sensitive, to be vulnerable along with Meg. And there are certainly instances where they show that vulnerability, and you'll get to see some of that in book two.
I'm really excited to get a chance to read it over the next probably 2 weeks. You know, and you clearly have a huge amount of books on the back burner ready to come out. Jamie, where can people find you and where can they get in contact with you or find your books?
Okay. So you can find my books on Amazon. Basically that's it. I have the first one up in Barnes and Noble, but I need to like update it and then put book two up there. So, you know, just so that way people have that option. But if you want an ebook, you can only go to Amazon because it is available on Kindle Unlimited. And then to find me, I'm on Twitter at Villain Leaning and TikTok and Instagram.
We need to talk that your most recent TikTok was really good. And I've been intimidated by it.
I spent a ridiculous amount of time.
How long?
Oh my God. Okay. So it was at least a good 2 to 3 hours, like between sitting there and getting the recording, because like the way, since it's, you know, blinking past pages, basically the way I had to do it was like open up the book, set it up in front of the camera, hit the record button, hit stop, and just like keep doing that. And that probably like for 30 seconds of footage, it was like an hour just to record it. And then, I'm sitting there and I had, you know, I had made a note about what it was I wanted for the text. So you're having to sit there and like, because you can set the duration for the text, right? You put the first thing up and then I'm having to sit here and fiddle
with like
with the
exactly
duration
yeah.
right there on the beat. And I'm like, oh my
God. Look
what
you did. You are a person who TikToked, and you TikToked for an absurdly long amount of time for 30 seconds.
Oh, it was absurdly long. This is exactly why video editors get paid what they get paid.
Did you get really tired and exhausted afterwards?
Oh my God. Like, by the time I had that thing ready to post and got it up there, I was like, I'm done. I'm not doing anything else for the rest of the day. How do people do this for a living? Because you're having to be so fiddly about these things and playing with these. And these are just little sliders on my phone. I can't imagine what you have to do when you're using like all that equipment on the computer and you have like different layers and things like that that you're putting in and out. Because my husband does do graphic design in addition to all his other IT stuff. And like, I'm watching him play with these layers and things like that. And I'm like, how can you stand doing that?
TikTok is an amazingly powerful editing app for what it does.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine being someone who's actually educated in that kind of stuff. And
I'm sitting here watching him because, he was fixing the formatting for the cover art so I can finally get a hardcover option up there. Just ordered my print.
Hey, yes.
Yeah. So that'll be out there eventually. But he's like sitting here fiddling with it and taking layers in and out and resizing things. And I'm like, literally, my eyes are just glazing over just watching him mess with
what
these
is
things.
This magic?
Yeah. I'm like, what do you? I can't even tell what he's doing and what he's changing, but it's changing things. And I'm like, what is going on?
What is this? What is this dark magic you've done?
What is this? And like, you know, I could have just asked Tyler, I guess for like the right measurements and stuff like that, but you know, he's got his own graphic design company that he's running. And I don't want to be like popping in there like, hey,
it's really hard to actually, like, when you've got these amazingly talented people around you who are, even when you've hired them, like, you're like, I don't want to bother them. I'm going to be fine with what I have.
I don't want to be annoying, but could you do this?
That was actually my experience fairly recently. I love the guy who did the audiobook for my book. And he's so pro. He's so good. This is his livelihood, right? And there was one point where in the editing, it's like I'm not blaming the dude at all. Like, I totally get it. At the beginning of a chapter, it goes 26. And I was like, oh my God, what do I do? Do I tell him? And so I didn't tell him. And so it's up there. And then finally, my brother was like, hey, John. There's a point at which you say the word 26 twice. And he was like, seriously? Fuck. So he like fixed it. But I'm like, but I feel so bad. I don't want to confront anybody. I don't want to ask them for like even that much more because what they've already done is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Like just the art that he had done for the first and the second book. And like, I didn't even want to bother him because when we were looking at the stuff for the first cover and Amazon is like, you should size it this way, which, you know, wider than it is tall.
Yeah.
Measurements that they give you. But then depending on the kind of Kindle people have,
it will look different.
The cover doesn't show up. The cover doesn't show up. It's just this blank thing that's like title of the book.
Come on, Amazon.
I was like, wait a second. These are your measurements.
Yeah. What am I supposed
to
do?
Why would it not show up? Yeah, exactly. What am I supposed to do? And so like, you know, I didn't want to bother him about fixing the measurements on that one image, or even because he had sent me just the front cover as well, but as a PDF. So it would have been, you know, the correct stuff, but it was a PDF. So I couldn't put that up because they want a JPEG or a TIFF. And so my husband converted the file just yesterday. So now the correct size is up
cool.
There.
Okay.
Show up the way it's supposed to now.
This is what it's like being a writer with anxiety. We just don't want to bother people who have already done it.
Don't want to bother people. I didn't want to go back to my cover artist and be like, hey, this needs to be a JPEG.
Well, the only time I ended up, my cover artist that I had done for one of these, I'd finally said, I was like, hey man, can you actually move your signature a little more visibly? Like, can you move it to the center a little bit? Because I don't want to cut it off. Like, but even that, a thing that I was like, I want to make sure that like your signature's on here. Even that felt like it was like potentially bothering someone. And I don't want to do that. It's like,
I don't want to be annoying, but could we just like shift this a tiny bit? Tweak
it? And of course, like, I'm sure they're probably like, that's fine. Because good product for you is good product for me.
Yeah. And I think I got extremely lucky because Tyler is my husband's brother. So I have all these in-laws that if I have questions, I can be like, hey, how does this
cars
work?
Formatting? Cars,
formatting, cover art. More than one of them have been in the military. So if I have military questions, all I have to do is be like, hey.
Do any of them have a go bag?
No, surprisingly.
Do you have a go bag?
I do not have a go bag.
What would be in your go
bag? In my snacks.
What kind of snacks?
They're, you know, it'd probably be like peanut butter crackers and stuff like that. Things that I can like toss in there that aren't going to go bad. You know, Twinkies, things like that.
I can just see
you
now like leaving and be like, guys, I don't have a raincoat. I just got these Twinkies. So Jamie,
I grabbed some of the canned goods out of the pantry. Like, what do you
here's want? These garbanzo beans and some old peas. Jamie, is there anything that we didn't get to that you wanted to talk about or that you wanted to share with people or say? Because after about an hour in, my brain starts shutting down and all my questions go to the wayside and I just have a good time talking.
I have no idea. Like, see, this is the problem. Neither one of us have working brains. wherever it goes, that's cool. Well,
I would like to invite people, please pick up a copy of Jamie's books. The second one just came out, Torment and Tarnish. It is on, is that on Kindle Unlimited as well?
They are both on Kindle Unlimited.
So you are not hurting your wallet. You can only literally get a great story out of it and also ensure that an indie author gets paid. So read it. Drop a review. Reviews are always super helpful, regardless of what that review is. You're in for a great time. Fear and Fury was legitimately one of my favorite books that I read this past year. And I mean that honestly. It was such a good time. I am always looking for new series to jump into, especially first person series. I'm so glad to know that there's so much more to follow up with. And you've done a killer job, my friend. And I can't wait to see where the rest of these books go.
Thank you.
Make sure you follow Jamie on Twitter, on TikTok, where she's doing better than I am. And I don't mean that in numbers. I mean that in the sense that she's just better at TikToking and I need to take lessons. And find her. Do you have a website?
No, I do not.
She does not have a website.
So. I don't have a website. And I don't know that I would tell you guys if I did have a website. I'd be like, no.
Do you have a live journal?
I do not. I do not have a live journal.
Maybe you were a goth kid and you had a dead journal. Do you remember that? It was like this really, like, I might even still be around, but it was like live journal for goth kids.
I did not have any of those.
I didn't really either.
I was like the kid who hid in their room and read.
Me too.
I did not go anywhere.
Well, Jamie, it's been awesome talking to you today. I really appreciate you taking your time, especially on a Monday, to hang out with me.
Thank you for inviting me. This is a lot of fun.
Everybody, get Fear and Fury, get Torment and Tarnish. There are at least 7 books afterwards that you can absolutely fall in love with as they come out. So do so. Make sure to check us out on the QBC podcast at Twitter. Check out some of our other episodes as well. And Jamie, you're like the next to last QBC conversation for this year. So thanks for like making the time to come hang out with me.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You are super welcome. Guys, grab our books and remember, support indie authors, leave reviews, take care of yourselves. Have an awesome holiday. Have a good new year. I think this might be up after Christmas. I don't know yet. We're going to figure that one out. All right, Jamie, have an awesome rest of your day, okay? Have a good one.